This is Mae Bressel, and it is a second part of World Watchers, program number 776, and the final half hour on Nicholas Daniloff. I do want to do more next week, but I wanted to do these 2 weeks in succession. It's very important to understand him and, as I say, the response of the administration, of the news media, of the writers in the newspapers, the editorials and so forth, and the government officials, the intense response they have when a man was arrested just for a very few days, 9 or 10 days, the hysteria. And then put that side by side with the background that I shared with you on Daniloff and see why they were hysterical. That's why I did the background first, to give you a little bit of a view of why they were hysterical. September the 6th, Washington Post, headline, Schultz voices outrage with Soviets over reporter. He bars a direct swap of the spies. American press corps appealed for the correspondence release. These are their exact words. They demanded, they were outraged, they appealed. Quotes, Daniloff's arrest impeded the journalists from doing their work and thus violated the Helsinki Accords. This was the charge. The actions against Daniloff are an attempt to intimidate every member of the media community in Moscow. Now keep in mind, how many people in the media community, I'm afraid to ask, have that background of Daniloff, with great-grandpa trying to kill a czar, with grandpa in the czar's intelligence, living in Paris during the, even as a child, during the Hitler days in Paris, and then moving to Argentina under Juan Perón, and going to Harvard and 4 years, and then to Oxford, and then being sent back to Russia in 1961, the whole area of Lee and Marina Oswald and Gary Powers' trial, and then going back to the Soviet Union in 1981 and trying to sabotage the, in goodness knows how many ways, but one we know, a typical gray area CIA, the chance for the Rules Committee vote in the House of, in Congress, the House of Representatives, to open up the John Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassination. And both the Martin Luther King assassination and the JFK assassination involved Priscilla McMillan, Priscilla Johnson McMillan, who was a journalist in Moscow who covered as a writer and author, who worked for the United States intelligence and for the State Department. She was involved with them, with the assassinations, rather, she and her husband, with the Martin Luther King and John Kennedy covering it up. She worked with John Kennedy in with Lee Oswald in Moscow, and was close to Marina as soon as Oswald was killed. Took her to Sedona, Arizona for a little bitty brainwashing, and then wrote a book about them. And disguised, as I say, as a journalist in Moscow at the same place where Daniloff is going to be, with the same kinds of feelings, violently anti-Russian. To say in the news media that Daniloff's arrest impeded all journalists from doing their work is, again, a disinformation quoted by George Schultz, blasting the Soviet Union at Harvard University and not mentioning, I don't believe in what I read, that Nicholas Daniloff graduated from there, and along with the ilk of Priscilla Johnson and Henry Kissinger and many of the other anti-communists at Harvard University, but suggesting that arrest impeded all journalists, or that every member of the media in Moscow is in danger because Daniloff was arrested. When he was working with space people, with the space program, with the biological weapons, with Tsarist white Russians, with refuseniks who want to get out of there, whose sympathies are with them, they put him in a ball of wax as all the others, but they don't have the honesty to tell you his background. They just tell you that if you take Daniloff, then no journalist is safe, which is another disinformation lie occurring right now at Harvard University celebrating their 350th anniversary. George Shultz used the speech to blast the Soviet Union and talk about Nicholas Daniloff. The New York Times, September the 6th, 1986, is titled, Shultz Demands the Soviet Free the U.S. Journalist. The other article from the Washington Post was, Schultz voices outrage with the Soviets. These are same articles the same day from different newspapers using different words, and he tells the public to be aware of this crisis and warns that Daniloff could soon begin to jeopardize Soviet-American relations. As again, this is only on the 6th of September. He's only been arrested August the 30th, and these adjectives are so important. The Secretary of State has an outrage. The Secretary of State demands. The U.S.-USA relations are in danger. As I say, who is he? It's just been 6 days. Washington Post, September the 7th. Ruth Daniloff's diary, headline, "I feel terrified for Nick." She says his cellmate is clearly a plant in the prison there, and that even though he was caught with two maps that were marked top secret, it isn't a big deal, and she feels terrified. She feels terrified, and he said if Reagan hadn't gotten him out, he would have been many years in the Soviet Union. They all knew he was guilty. They knew the things that he had done in the past that none of us know, and things that he was doing at the time. And it depended upon the President of the United States to jump in with a Secretary of State and every figure of speech, known and well-known and some unknown editorial writers, and the surprising, in quotes, liberal left pounding on this, unanimous in the importance of Daniloff. And again, at the time of the William Colby hearings between in Representative Pike's congressional hearings, there were 400 news people at the time working for the CIA. And Daniloff, in those earlier periods, when he went from 1961 and then working up until 75, that was supposed to stop. But again, in 1977, he's used by the UPI and quoted by Mark Lane. Now, September the 8th, Washington Post. Daniloff is indicted as a spy by the Soviets. And United States warned, Russia warned the United States, there are serious implications for the United States. The Soviet Union said, we're going to indict him, we have, and there are serious implications. And it's that turning point, September the 8th, where there is absolute hysteria about what is going on with Daniloff. We've got to get him out. It got so bad that by September the 18th or 19th, Mr. Shevardnadze was called to the White House, and I'll get to that, I hope so, in this half hour. The second part of this article, Washington Post, September the 8th, Larry Speaks was quoted, "The journalist is innocent. No trade possible, he's innocent." And then a quotation of parts of a letter sent by Ronald Reagan. "Last week, a personal letter was sent to Gorbachev from Ronald Reagan. Free Daniloff, he's not a spy. The Secretary of State, the President of the United States, and his spokesperson, Larry Speaks. The journalist is innocent, one says. The other says he's not a spy. And the Soviets get a letter from Ronald Reagan a week earlier. And 7 days later, they say he's indicted as a spy, which means we don't care what you think, Ronald Reagan. We don't care what you think, George Shultz. Or Larry Speaks, he has been indicted, and the letter from the president doesn't mean a thing." That was a week before that Ronald Reagan wrote, and they indicted him. Soviet Gerasimov, I don't know if I pronounced this right, charged that Daniloff doesn't deny the things he got in this envelope that were marked secret. Daniloff could stand a 6-month investigation, they said, and that he went to his meetings on his own will. He made this step, he has to take the consequences, and he hadn't said if there was money that he exchanged for the maps that he got. September the 8th, New York Times, and I quoted two Washington Post stories, one from the 7th and one from the 8th, titled, headlines, "Impact of a Case Called Serious by the White House." It gets very serious because Ronald Reagan wrote immediately to Gorbachev and said, let him out, he's not a spy, and 7 days later they say we indicted him. So now it's really serious. Impact of case called serious. Reagan is described as concerned on Daniloff. Now, Reagan, remember, in 1960, was put on the board of Young Americans for Freedom. Those very people were involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. They were involved with CIA activities. That was set up by William Buckley and Douglas Caddy, whose offices were used for the Watergate payments, and the former CIA, James McCourtney, Howard Hunt, and the rest that were all CIA that they called former CIA there. And then the White House got very concerned because what if he is tried as a spy? He can't be that innocent if they're so concerned. It's impossible. So then the article goes on, Shultz and Eduard Shevardnadze, the Soviet minister, will meet September the 19th and 20th to set a date for the meeting summit in the United States of Mr. Gorbachev. So there was no intention September the 8th, to put Mr. Shevardnadze into the White House, where he was pressured by Ronald Reagan, and as a consequence, Gorbachev sent a letter. He said, well, let's get off to Iceland and talk about this thing. The adjectives are terrified, serious, concerned, extremely distressed, and psychological pressure that is being put on Danilov, and I'm sure on a lot of other people, including the President of the United States, the State Department, and the CIA. Now, this one article from the New York Times continues. This is September the 8th. Jailed American charged in Soviet as being a spy. The Washington Post had that title, too, and formal accusation made. The move against the correspondent was made despite a letter from Reagan on his innocence, and that was in the headlines, those big letters by Felicity Barringer. So they announced right there, if you don't have to have it translated, as I did with the earlier article, that the USSR believes that Reagan is lying. And what would the Soviet Union have to gain by creating a false story of making Danilov a lie and aggravating the United States, who are always trying to prove them an evil empire? Danilov was charged with espionage. The actions were taken at a time when the Soviet Union wanted to arrange a summit conference. And this is pointed out in the article. And then there's a quotation of the foreign minister from the Soviet Union. If you think he's innocent, you can learn pretty well soon. There is going to be a trial. You can learn pretty soon, rather. There's going to be a trial. And he said this particular envelope was not the only thing we have against Danilov. Not the envelope he got from Misha with the maps marked top secret. We've had other problems with Danilov before. And they referred to Professor Frederick Bargorn, Bargoorn, from Yale, who was arrested and spying in the Soviet Union. A man had put papers in his hand. They were rolled up. He was seized by the security and charged with having classified information. And his arrest came 3 days, came after three Russians and American were arrested in the United States, and they were traded and released. That release was arranged November 16th after John Kennedy declared the Russian spy from Yale to be innocent. And then this article concludes from the New York Times. If they go ahead and try and sentence him, it's a personal insult to Ronald Reagan. Now, considering Ronald Reagan's role in the Kennedy assassination, his mentor, Patrick Frawley, employed Mr. Butler in New Orleans, who made a record with Oswald, Ed Butler, saying, I am a Marxist, the cover for influencing the media to switch it to a communist Cold War lying story that Mr. Khrushchev knew at the time wasn't true. Oswald wasn't a Marxist in the Soviet Union, and Ronald Reagan would not extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to Jim Garrison's trial, and he worked closely with the very people involved in the murder of John Kennedy and the cover-up of John Kennedy. So the way that this is twisted, and the news is very important, the way it's twisted around, it's the way they say, if you arrest Nicholas Danilov for being a spy, then no other newspaper reporter in Moscow is ever safe, which is a lie. Now they're saying, if you go ahead and sentence him, and the president told you not to, that he's not a spy, then you are personally insulting Ronald Reagan. And how bad can that be for the Soviet Union when he's such a popular president, to personally insult him? Well, obviously, Mr. Gorbachev wasn't worried about insulting Ronald Reagan when you consider the insults that they have taken over and over again. And the New York Times article concluded, Western journalists are in a furor over Danilov case. USSR said he has been made a hero of the day by the Western propaganda, and they were saying in the newspapers in Russia, Izvestia and other papers, that they made a hero out of him, which they wanted to do. Me think thou proclaimed protest too much, the quotation. The Soviet Union was watching a massive symphony orchestrated about the innocence of Danilov from everybody who has a fountain pen and can write, or a typewriter, or a computer. And he became a total hero in the United States that everybody wanted to free. U.S. News and World Report were selling sweatshirts, free Nicholas Danilov. And the Soviet Union said that Danilov was made to appear as naive, innocent victim of the tyranny of Soviet Russia and their authorities, and they make him appear as if he were a pawn in their political game of chess. That diabolical thing, again, of I am an innocent man. Interestingly enough, remember that it was Mrs. Danilov who said that 3 months earlier they knew there was going to be an arrest. But that was synchronized with the news media and carried out, and as I say, it boomeranged in many ways. Now, another article from September the 8th, continuing around the New York Times, a large heading, "A Long Ordeal for Cast for Reporter." Oh, this is a different story, September the 8th, New York Times, by Harold J. Berman. And this, again, is one of these slanted articles out of Harvard by a Harvard law professor. He was there from 1948. The CIA was formed in 1947 until 1985, last year. And he now teaches at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, an interesting place to be. And he was cited in the New York Times. "Nicholas Daniloff can face a long ordeal if the United States and USSR do not make political arrangements to free him." In other words, get off your butt, because if you don't do something, it's going to be late. He's definitely going to be locked in the clink for a long time. Now, the question, what is the hurry to get him out, that they used all of these ploys to say it's essential that we get him out, it's important that we get him out? And then there's another question that comes up again with the chronology that I gave last week on the chronology of Nicholas Daniloff. Where was he from 1973 to 1981? These eager beaver reporters find certain dates that they can locate him, but it doesn't say who he worked for in that time period. Now, he worked for UPI or with them or around them, obviously, in January of 1977 when this letter was sent or article by UPI that the people wanting to open up the investigation of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King were threatening Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, which didn't happen, in fact, and was traced to Daniloff on the very day they're going to vote whether the Rules Committee can investigate these murders. So this was a byline of the UPI. But where else was he? And if we know where he was from 1973 until 1981, it would give an important part of why they were so hysterical. Because part of this time period, I mentioned, he worked with the State Department, the White House, and the Defense Department. And he touched all bases. And his former classmate from Oxford was in charge of emigres from the Soviet Union. And we had a lot of them and a lot of propaganda and press coverage through these years about the emigres wanting to come here. Now, Harold Berman, who was at Harvard teaching law, said he made fun of the Soviet system of law, and he wrote a book called Soviet Criminal Law and Procedures. And quoted in the New York Times are some remarks of his. He said, "The USSR makes their own laws, and they want them obeyed. They're eager to give their system legitimacy in the eyes of their own people and in the eyes of the world, even though the law is abused when important political considerations come to the fore." Now, he's an expert on Soviet law from Harvard, 1948 to 1985, that whole time span of the anti-Soviet departments there. But in a book written by Seymour Melman about Nazi Germany, he went into great lengths on how law was perverted from 1922 until Hitler was elected in 1933. Then there were no more laws. And how they manned to make the courts appear to be working and legitimate, where guilty people and involving political assassinations and liberals and the left, and changing the fabric of Germany from the Weimar Republic into Hitler's fascist Third Reich, the guilty, the assassins, and the people involved in murders were out, and the innocent were locked up, and one of their largest problems was perverting the court. Now, the minute the war was over, we hired Reinhard Galen, who, with his family, his brother, and families, worked in the process of covert action for Adolf Hitler that was part of this operation of assassination and cover-up. And we took these jurists and these lawyers and made them our co-workers and worked with them at forming our intelligence community and with Reinhard Galen. And we put Galen back over there in charge of the intelligence, the BND. And there never was a critique or a criticism of the legal establishment that worked with the United States from those early days on to the present day, and international legal meetings and so forth. So there's no objection to persons in the OSS, CIA, the American Bar Association, such as Leon Jaworski, who was president of the American Bar Association, being an attorney advisor to the Warren Commission and outright lying on the murder of John Kennedy and naming a false patsy Lee Oswald when the connections were so much bigger. the inconsistency of people like Harold Berman looking the other way while we have pathological liars in the legal profession, and then accusing the Soviet Union. And I don't want you to think I think the Soviet Union's perfect, but it is nauseating to see the establishment people cited when crises come out like this, such as bad-mouthing what they do in Russia when we accept it. Mr. Pinochet has no great legal system, nor does the president in South Korea or Mr. Xi in Pakistan and our allies, the Chang family in Taiwan, you name it. And the military dictatorships we had with Klaus Barbie and his gang in Bolivia, and the military dictatorship that Vernon Walters and the CIA put in Brazil. There were no legal systems there, and there was no legitimacy in the eyes of the people anywhere in the world about the legal systems in the dictatorships, such as the Savak ran for the Shah of Iran after the CIA put him in, and I could cite 44 countries going this way. So when Danilov is arrested, this professor from law, who's the expert on Soviet Union, tells you that he will naturally be convicted because they will forge the evidence, and that's the way they work. Nobody's innocent in Russia because they write their own laws. Just forgetting the whole background of Danilov and all the bases he touched, God forbid there was some reason for the Russians to believe and stand up to the fact that he was a spy, and that's what they chose to do. Now, in the same article, Professor Leon Lipson from Yale University is quoted. He's an expert on the Soviet legal system. He said, if the Soviet Union continues to make the advances in civil liberties and legal procedures it made since the 1940s and 50s, we can look forward to the day, perhaps in 25 years, when it reaches the level of Franco Spain. Now, again, the Vatican and Germany and the United States liked Franco Spain. They supported him. Charles Willoughby, the head of intelligence for Douglas McCarthy, the real Wiedenbach, his name is, from Germany, he got Congress to give Franco over $35 million, and we gave him many, many millions more than that. We never asked for trials and juries in Franco Spain. He was an ally of ours. We appreciated his relationship, just as Marcos of the Philippines and the legal system there. You could compare the dictatorships that we have supported and put into power and compare them to the Soviet system. And if you're going to level these charges and use these experts from Yale and Harvard who make themselves experts, then the public has to be reminded of the outright hypocrisy of these people pulling this. Every time there's a crisis, they come out of the woodwork with their pat answers, and every time they do that, it gets us psychologically ready to go to war. Now, September 8th, the New York Times had an article by Anthony Lewis, What Gorbachev Risks. He says the stakes are high in the Danilov affair. Gorbachev sent many signals, but he's ready to deal. First, he says he's ready to deal, and then he's ready to have the trial. He can't be open. He assumed the leadership of the Soviet Union that he would be open. He blew that hollow claim with the Chernobyl disaster. And keep in mind Danilov's close relationships to the space industry and I presume the astronauts and scientists in Russia. He says, how can we deal with a system that resorts to transparent inventions as planted evidence as spying? Anthony Lewis, given the background of Danilov that I've shared with you last week and this week, these are transparent inventions and planted evidence. He said, if Danilov charges are pressed, no American would go to a summit conference. If you charge Danilov, what if something came out at the trial? What if the Soviet Union knows about any possible links to Chernobyl? What do they know about him? When Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald were there, Anthony Lewis is saying if the Soviet Union pressed charges, no one should go to a summit conference. You shouldn't talk about arms reduction, Star Wars, atomic testing. The most important thing, the litmus paper, is Danilov. We've got to get him home. Now, that's a lot of nervousness. That's a lot of anxiety. The New York Times the next day had a story. Soviet indicates Danilov faces wider charges. Now, that makes it worse because they're past those maps and so forth. And the article says the USSR will link Danilov to an American diplomat expelled last year. I mentioned him, Paul Stombaugh. And then it went in about Danilov's contacts with Misha. He first met in 1982. And then he met a year later, and on the telephone, as I say, they agreed to meet at a certain place. And this article about further charges said Daniloff allegedly requested military information relating to Afghanistan, photographs of Soviet military equipment, names and addresses of soldiers who fought in Afghanistan for the Soviets, the location of military units prepared for action in Afghanistan. Now, when Lee Harvey Oswald returned from the Soviet Union with his wife, June 1962, they went to Fort Worth, and before they could barely unpack their few meager belongings and allegedly had no money and kept their baby named June in the drawer of a bureau, opened, of course, not closed, he went to a secretary named Pauline Bates, and he dictated about Soviet troop movements and tanks and observances from airplanes from ground level and so forth, things that he was able to see going out to the country on the weekends, working at the Minsk radio factory run by Mr. Zeiger from Argentina, who is closely affiliated with our Central Intelligence Agency. This very poor Lee Harvey Oswald goes to the American Embassy in Moscow, and they give him money for him and his wife to come home, and he did indeed keep his citizenship. All that stuff about giving the Soviet Union secrets of the Marines was a bunch of BS. And he was privy to secrets enough to go to a secretary, and there were affidavits of Pauline Bates when the Warren Commission hearings were taken. The first plans were for the Texas courts to investigate the murder of Kennedy, or there would be no Pauline Bates that we know about. The only reason we know about these people, again, is that the news media synchronized, blamed the Soviet Union and Russia and Fidel Castro for the murder of Kennedy. Nobody around the world believed it, so Lyndon Johnson had to form a commission upon which he put Alan Dulles of the Central Intelligence Agency, former director fired by John Kennedy, and John J. McCloy, who had been in Paris for 10 years before World War II broke out, represented the law interests of I.G. Farben, worked for and on the board of Chase Manhattan Bank, and then released the top Nazis out of Germany in a very short time after the Nuremberg trial so that they could all meet again in Argentina and Peru and Brazil and Bolivia and Paraguay and so forth and begin their resurgence of the Fourth Reich. Now, another article, December the 9th, Moscow levels new charges, and then it goes on, the Soviet government has extended the hard line even further. The New York Times had one story, Daniloff faces wider charges. The Washington Times is the Reverend Moon paper. The charges go even further. The new charges will carry a penalty of 15 years, sometimes life. It is not clear if the Daniloff case will lead to a cancellation and proposed summit later this year. That was written September the 9th. Little did they know that by October, Gorbachev would be meeting with Ronald Reagan because all the junk they were writing forced a meeting, and Daniloff was the numero uno issue and in strategic places at the right time made it very impossible that he could stand trial. And also, if there was a connection between Reagan's friends and Young Americans for Freedom and the Moscow clique, which those relationships can be tied together, Reagan would want him home, and Daniloff was not somebody to be kept in the Soviet Union. Ruth Daniloff said in the Washington Times, "It's just for domestic consumption, the new charges. While this case is being decided," she said, "at a much higher level." Now, she knows about that. She was at Oxford when he was there in England and accompanied him to the Soviet Union two times. And then she reveals parts of herself in the articles that she has published. I wish I had more time just to talk about Ruth Daniloff, because unknowingly she lets things out, such as saying we knew for 3 months that he was going to be arrested by the KGB. And then she says that these charges are something that involve a much higher level, and you can believe they do. And the only thing that comes to my mind that would be so important, in addition to where he was before in Russia, was his link to the Soviet space program and the catastrophe at Chernobyl that I believed, as I say, was a sabotage to put them in the position they're in, which is defensive ever since. There was a call to Daniloff, she said, and quote in the newspaper, from this Misha, who said, "I am Prince. Let's meet at the usual place at 11 o'clock under the Iron Bridge." And, of course, knowing that for 3 months you're going to be arrested, it's interesting that you would answer to somebody that you haven't seen for a year. And then he's handed, Danilov has handed a map of Afghanistan, marked secret, and, as I say, pictures of military hardware and so forth. Now, the hysteria of the newspaper, I don't have time to go through some of the top articles. I have about 20 titles here. Just the titles alone are very, very important to show the importance of Danilov. But this hour is over again, and probably next week I'll do part three, at least a half hour, on Nicholas Danilov, and then get back to some of the other news that has been taking place or has taken place the last 2 weeks, and get back to that. But I do want to continue on this man because I think he's more important than any of us know, but the powers that be know that fact and make it quite clear. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussel. The program is called World Watchers, and I'll be back with you next week.